Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We're your host for this weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, where, man, we just continue to cover these pretty wild markets and markets that continue to drift lower. And this week, it was another big week with the Fed meeting, also a surprise ECB meeting, but again, the Fed and their 75 basis point hike, again, just showed investors, it seems like at least right now, how serious the Fed is to try to get inflation under control. And they seem to be okay with markets continuing to correct. And that's what we saw after that statement. We are kicking off the show in the first few segments with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. This is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail or individual side, Rick writes in the No Trader, as well as a piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the overall goal to beat the S&P. And we've heard from Rick recently that, boy, oh boy, has he ever been beating that S&P. Rick, let's start off broadly, though, with the Fed decision, the Fed meeting this week where the Fed hiked rates by 75 basis points. It didn't seem like that hike, that 75 basis points, was on the table until after that most recent inflation number, which happened two Fridays ago. And then the markets, boy, oh boy, did we see market interest rates scream higher. Rick, first and foremost, what was your takeaway from that 75 basis point hike by the Fed?
Well, hi, Corey, and hi, Shad. I think that the Fed was forced to do 75. It was probably not their initial intent, but after that number came out and the way Fed fund futures were priced, I think they had no choice but to do 75. If they had done the 50 that had been the consensus number up until a few days before the announcement, I think they would have been looked at as being very weak and still very behind the curve of what needed to be done. So I think they were pretty much forced to do the 75 bip hike.
Well, Rick, when you look at, you know, the trajectory that they're on to continue doing these rate hikes, there's been some messaging that came out recently. They ultimately want to get the Fed funds rate up. They say between a target of 3-4%. We've seen a lot of market turbulence, though, just on these first three hikes. So do you think that it's actually something where they're going to ignore even more market weakness just to temper the demand side of the equation since they can't really affect supply and just go ahead and plow forward with it? Or is there potentially a breaking point where if the market makes enough noise, they just may have to pause and at least wait to see what they've done, what effects it has?
I think for the time being, you have to look at it that the Fed is not going to care a heck of a lot about what happens to the stock market. They have a mandate to have inflation under control, and they have lost control of that issue. And that is one of two main mandates they have. I think to save face, they're going to have to do what they need to in order to rein in inflation, which is going to mean significantly higher rates over time, potentially quite a bit of it this year. And whatever happens to the stock market happens to the stock market. I think they're going to be less concerned now about that particular asset pricing and have to do what they have to do. Look, they let things get out of control for years. They eased when easing was not needed. Their balance sheet is significant. They need to unwind that and they need to get inflation under control. So Chairman Powell just got elected to another 4 years. He really needs to kind of save face. And I think that is going to be their primary goal now. And they fueled the stock market rally for years. They may need to be the same reason that the stock market comes off.
So, Rick, do you think inflation could significantly come down in, say, the next 3 to 6 months until the end of the year with all these rate hikes when you combine the slowdown in the economy? Sentiment is also getting lower. Consumers are starting to run out of money here. Could inflation correct almost just as fast as it went up?
I don't think it'll correct as fast as it went up, but I think that the slowdown that's likely to occur, both from ridiculously high food prices and over $5 at the pump gas prices, there is and will be a continued slowdown in people's discretionary spending. One of my daughters lives in Tampa, Florida, and she works in Bradenton, Florida, which is a 50-mile drive in each direction each day. And it's all highway driving, but it's costing her a chunk of money to get to and from work each week. And, you know, that's going to be something where her salary hasn't been upped because of that huge increase in you know, her expenditure to get to work. She'll have to do with less elsewhere. And I think that's just a very typical example of the high price of oil and driving your car. I think people are going to stop and think now about when they make trips, or can they combine trips, and am I going to take that, you know, hour drive to take a nice nature walk on the weekend somewhere? I think a lot of that becomes very conscious in people's minds now. And that in and of itself will help decrease demand as we potentially roll towards a recession. Go to the supermarket and see what you're paying for, you know, prices of things. It's gotten crazy, and it's going to get a heck of a lot worse. So I think the inflationary pressures when it comes to food prices are not close to being at the highs. So to answer your question, yes, we could see a tempering of inflation over the next 6 months simply because the demand picture decreases. Nonetheless, the inflationary numbers will still be well above the target that the Fed has set, and it's still going to impact people's spending habits.
Yeah, remember when the Fed only had a 2% target? And now they've shot way past that. So even if inflation was to temper down, Rick, to your point, prices are already so high just from the last 2 years of what's happened that even if we have a slower rate of inflation, it'd still be on much higher prices. And they're probably not going back to where they were pre-pandemic. So it's just going to be another force people deal with. And the wage increases that people have gotten at their employment are not keeping up with these price increases. So do you think there's a point where, to your to the point about the food cost and energy cost eating into discretionary spending, that this may hit the balance sheets of companies in a big way, and we may start seeing the consumers, which have so far been pretty strong, not be there for retail, for consumer discretionary, for some of those sectors? You know, are you worried about some of those sectors maybe having bad earnings reports in the next two quarters?
Well, look, when I think that the earnings revisions numbers are coming down on the street, and yet the market has not come down as much as the earnings revisions are coming down, which leads me to believe that we're not done going down. Now, we can get a bounce at any time. We can't really judge today and tomorrow's price action as necessarily a reaction to what the Fed did, because tomorrow's a triple witch, or even we'll say a quadruple witch. So if you look at open interest in like spider at the money and like the at the money puts, there's huge open interest. I saw this morning the 370s, and of course now we're trading lower than that in the spiders. We're in the upper 360s, but the 370s had something like 80,000 puts that expire tomorrow. And another maybe close to, I think, 60 or 80,000 at the 350 level. I mean, there's huge downside hedging that's going on. And the people on the other side of it, you know, are now dealing with the fact that they've got huge open interest in puts that are going, as of right now, are priced against them. So I'm not going to look at today and tomorrow's price action necessarily as being the true response to the Fed. And I think that at any time, certainly given how oversold the market is, we could always see a bounce. But I've said it all year. I've said it to you guys before. We are minimally in a two-way trading market as compared to what we've seen in the past, which was purely buy the dips. You didn't have to worry about selling. It was just buy the dips. We are in a two-way market where you also need to sell rallies. And the question is, are we even going to see rallies to sell into? You know, we had one a few weeks ago, and it stopped near 4150, which is in the S&P, which is kind of where we broke down from. So it was very natural and obvious place that the market stopped and has now made new lows. There are always certain targets. So I said, I think it was last month's show with you guys, and maybe even the month before, I've had a 3617 downside target for the S&P this year. I can't say that's going to be the bottom, but that's what, you know, we've been playing for and thinking was likely going to happen for months already. Where we're trading now, we're only 60 points or so away from it, which is only a little more than 1%. So we're getting closer to some targets, and it doesn't mean it has to stop there. But given the bull market that's been in place for years, and of course you had the COVID sell-off, but then if you look at what the market did since the COVID bottom, which if I remember correctly, I think it was something like 2,200 in the S&P. So we more than doubled the price of the S&P since March of 2020. Even if the market came off 30% this year and gave back last year's gains, we're still up dramatically in the last couple of years, and certainly since the Fed started their easy money back in 2009, when the S&P got to, what was it, 667. This is part of the normal give and take of what happens in markets. And the thing is, a lot of people haven't really lived through bear markets before, and how they trade. And the COVID market was such a quick thing. We sold off, in a month and a half, we went from virtually, if I remember correctly, where all-time highs to, that bottom in March. It was a dramatic sell-off from an exogenous event that was extremely fast. This is a more steady decline. It's been happening. Just look at your charts since January 1st, we're pretty much straight down with a couple of trading bounces along the way. And there's nothing yet to indicate that any of the up moves we get now are going to be anything more than trading bounces. And honestly, I hope we get some to still lighten up.
Yeah, it's a pretty nasty market. And again, to your point, a lot of investors haven't lived through a true bear market. Some of the most recent bear markets have come so quickly and so sharply that the rebounds have almost mirrored that and been very quick and sharp. Rick, how do you compare this time to bear markets in the past? Give everybody some context on how you think this is similar to other bear markets, in a way kind of ignoring some of these, in a way, flash crashes that we've had.
Right. Well, so one of the things, and I'm glad you just even used the term bear markets, because I do a lot of interviews, and of course I have my The No Trader podcast every week. One of the things that I've made a big point of is that I really think the press has done a disservice to the public by only, what was it, earlier this week, finally saying that we had a bear market, because they're so stuck on this 20% number for the S&P. So we got 19.9% and had a bounce, and they go, oh, the market's not in a bear market. It has traded like a bear market all year. And to first, who is the intended audience when you say now we're in a bear market? Is that supposed to have, oh, well, now the average Joe should consider selling because we've sold off 20% from a high? I mean, to me, it's utter foolish. It's just bad journalism, and I'm really disappointed, and I see it across the scope of it's the major newspapers, the major television channels that people watch that report on the news are saying, now we're finally in a bear market. Well, hello, what do you think we've been doing all year? Market has traded like that all year. The NASDAQ has been like that for over a year. It's just kind of silly. So now when you talk about, what do we do with a bear market? Is this different than others? Well, the last real bear market, we'll say, was from the peak in 2007 to the bottom in March of 2009. And that was the great financial crisis. And this, we're starting to see similarities in the sense of the severe declines, the minimal bounces, the fact that there's some real structural issues. And in this case, instead of it being mortgages blowing up, it's really the fact that the Fed has lost control over the inflation picture and has forced rates higher. Remember, it's just a short time ago, within, I guess, last year, year and a half, give or take, that there was no other place to put your money but the stock market. Interest rates were darn close to zero, right? The U.S. 10-year got down to 40 basis points. The short, with the 3-month treasuries were, 15 bips or something like that. I mean, there was nowhere to put your money except the stock market. And then the Fed loses the battle against inflation, which they never seemed to care about until it was already a bad situation. And now they force rates higher, which means that bonds that you owned have lost considerable price value. So you've had huge capital losses on your bonds. The stocks are now down 20 plus percent in S&P terms, 30 plus percent in NASDAQ terms. Bitcoin has fallen, 60%, something like that. The only thing that's kind of held up is gold. And so gold has been a good hedge. You're not making money with gold, but you're not losing money. And in that respect, it's the hedge that you'd want it to be. In the very simple terms, is you're not losing money by being in gold when all these other asset classes are going down. So the typical risk on assets have now kind of fallen apart, and gold has at least held steady. And it would have done much better if it wasn't for the dollar flying. But the dollar's on multi-year highs.
That's a good point, Rick, about the gold just being a good hedge and not losing money when everything else is crashing, which is kind of its role in one's portfolio as a sort of insurance product, and even in the face of a flying dollar. But I guess one of the points you just made was, I think, right on, that the financial media is usually late to the game. By the time they plant their flag and declare it a bear market, it's been pretty obvious for many, many months. I mean, really, since the third quarter and fourth quarter of last year, we started seeing certain sectors begin their rollover, and that's only continued. So I'm curious, Rick, as someone that does the 7-Eleven report, and you're able to continue to rotate into the sectors that are going to outperform the other 11 as a general rule of thumb, what do you look for? I mean, I know you look at behavioral psychology, quantitative analysis, technical analysis, the fundamental backdrop, but how can investors take a page out of your book, Rick, and get into these trends or position their portfolio before the mainstream media announces it?
Well, so part of it is the anticipation. You've got to be able to anticipate what happens. Think about it was right Wayne Gretzky who said something like, "I go to where the puck is going to be, not where it is." Right. So he was great because he can anticipate where the puck was going to go to. I think part of what we do at In the Know Trader and is different than most is we're better than most at anticipating the changes that are going to take place from a sector point of view before it's obvious to everyone else. Case in point, let's say last summer we went overweight financials when nobody wanted to touch them. We went overweight in August energy, and energy was near its 20-year historical all-time low versus the S&P. But the models we use, including, as you said, quant, technical, behavioral strategy, we combine them all to anticipate where the changes are going to be before something's moved 20%. And then everybody goes, oh, I guess it's no longer a bear market. It must be a bull market. And it's in that respect, in the month of May, the 7-Eleven report outperform. In fact, it had its best month in the 22-month history that since we started it in August of 2020. It outperformed the S&P by 165 basis points just in the month of May alone. Year to date, we're outperforming by 344 basis points through May 31st. For our fiscal year, we're up by 4.4%, which started August of last summer. And in the 22 months since we started 7-Eleven, we've outperformed by 698 basis points. So basically 7% in less than 2 years. simply by being able to anticipate better than most the shifts in the sectors before they're obvious. And the what can an investor do? Well, they could subscribe to the 7-Eleven report. It's very inexpensive. It comes out once a month on the last day of the month to give you new allocations for the next month. And frankly, I give this away for like ridiculously low price. It's $87 a month if you go month by month, and it's only the equivalent of $74 a month if you go and pay for the whole year up front. For less than $100 a month, you're getting access to some of the most sophisticated institutional models that exist to play this game. And, you know, I'm doing this over 40 years. I've been on the street. And I think that it's kind of a no-brainer to look at the markets the way we do and kind of get access to that. If you think about it, guys, being up the numbers like we are would put us in the top 10% of all money managers out there. So if this was an actual fund, we'd be in the elite, the top decile of all active money managers. So we don't manage your money. We're actually working on hopefully putting an ETF together, but that will be tracking the 7-Eleven. But until and if that comes out, I think it's not about tooting my horn. It is, we have the results to prove that what we do works, and it works consistently.
Good on you, Rick. Toot your own horn, because as well you should. You're beating the S&P in a time that a lot of people are having a lot of trouble and, quite frankly, just absolutely hating these markets. Let's dive into a couple sectors then, starting with Simply Energy. Oil's come off a little bit, but most recently had a breakout above 120 for crude. Still looking strong, but I think it is finally getting pulled down a little bit by the markets. Are you still invested in oil? What is your positioning there?
So we are invested in XLE. It is one of the seven of the 11 that we're in. And it has been our largest percentage overweight of any sector, which is part of how we've had such good returns. But literally on June 1st, we cut our exposure by 30%. So I'm still overweight XLE, but by a considerably less amount than we were coming into this month. And even though energy is still outperforming and the best performing sector, it's come well in relative terms. And again, we could kind of anticipate that this was the time and place that was likely to happen. And I can tell you that I do think the long-term relative bottom is in place in energy, and therefore I do not anticipate going less than a neutral to benchmark weighting going forward. In other words, I do not anticipate seeing myself have energy be an underweight going forward, but I did anticipate that, you know, this is an area that this could easily stall in relative performance terms. And a lot of people came to the game late. And that's why timing is such an important thing, too. And people say, oh, you can't time the markets. Well, it's part of what I've done for 40 years. It's how my name and reputation on the street is built on being one of the most prominent trading strategists on the street. And I take 40 years worth of experience to this. I'm not some 26-year-old quant who says, here's how you beat the market. 40 years of experience, having been a commodities floor trader for my first 12 years out of college, then on to Morgan Stanley in the commodities department, then Bloomberg came after me and I became the head of all of commodities, futures, and technical analysis at Bloomberg, and I actually designed their whole charting system. Then I went back to Morgan Stanley and was made chief market strategist. And a few roles since then, 40 years of experience takes you a long ways in having seen cycles and understanding markets and having been a trader and then on the sell side and then on the buy side gives me a unique perspective that a lot of people on the street don't have. And I think it it makes a huge difference in understanding how markets work and trade, because I've been in all three roles of trader, sell side, and buy side.
Well, Rick, let's talk about commodities, because you have such a vast experience there. Aside from energy, aside from oil and gas, what is your take on the rest of the commodity sector, be it the metals or the agricultural commodities, the soft commodities? What's your outlook?
So in general, I think we're still in a longer term up move. But right now, I think commodities are in a pullback phase. You'll have a chance, to get them lower. So I think the grains stall out a bit. I think the metals have already stalled. If anything, they're getting just a little bit of a safety bid. If the dollar comes off, and I think up between 104 and about 106.5 in the dollar index is not a bad place to be thinking of fading the dollar. Bullish consensus is quite high on the dollar. And, you know, we've hit multiple targets, and some people say we broke out, but to me, we haven't really officially broken out yet. So I don't mind looking for the dollar to potentially get a bit of a pullback here and possibly get back under 100. So with that, I think that in general, commodities are going to stall, but I like them longer term. I'm still looking. I'd be looking to be a buyer. Usually I tend to play the sector as a complete sector, using, you know, one of the popular ETFs like the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. The ticker on that is GSG. I think you get nice exposure to the, you know, broad market, broad exposure in the commodity sector there. It's not too heavily leaned towards the energy side the way like the CRB index is. So I think longer term, you still want to be in commodities. But if we get any slowdown here, I think you're going to see, you know, some of the demand just decrease. But in the big picture, when you look at the effects of the worldwide food shortage because of what's happened in the Ukraine, it's hard to see that, let's say, the basic grains like corn, wheat, and soybeans are going to get substantial pullbacks. But I do think near term, they certainly could pause. So I don't want to necessarily chase right now. I do like the sector longer term, though.
So, Rick, a little off topic here. I want to talk about the financial sector, because financial stocks or banks usually do better when rates are higher. Now, of course, this isn't just a story of rates being higher and everything else being okay. The economy's struggling. The markets are struggling. That's clearly weighing on the financial sector. Do you see this as a sector that when things settle at whatever time that may be and however much longer financials might move down, that they could bounce back because we should be in a higher interest rate environment?
Yeah, in general, yes. You know, and I think a lot of people have been caught off guard about how the financials have done in relative terms to the S&P, because it is a sector that traditionally, with higher rates, banks are going to make money on the float and the difference between borrowing short term and lending long term, and, you know, banks like higher interest rates. If you look at where the XLF is versus the S&P, you're kind of the same price you were a year ago, and yet interest rates are much, much higher. I think it was a crowded trade, and B, the speed at which rates moved higher is what has bothered people in the from being able to move that sector higher. You'd naturally think that the big move up in rates would quickly help the banks' balance sheets, but it's not. And the investors are concerned. The best thing that could happen for financials is slow movement higher. Not the fact that, you know, just a few weeks ago we were at 1.7% in the 10-year, and we got to, you know, 2.5 very quickly. We went from 1.8 to 2.5 very quickly. And I think it's the speed at which interest rates are changing that has the most concern for people right now. So I am overweight financials, not a large amount, but it is one of the sectors that I do have exposure in. So it's one of the seven, and it is a slight overweight. But it's, you know, if you look at this also topped out kind of early first quarter versus the S&P, and it's just kind of sitting there and can't advance. in relative terms. And I think it's the speed at which these rates have moved up.
Well, Rick, I'll open it up to you to any other sectors that you think may present the ability to have outsized gains compared to other sectors. And that maybe just means that they won't pull back as much as other sectors if there's a further washout. But are there any other sectors, you know, be it consumer staples, consumer discretionary, tech, anything else, the healthcare that has your attention right now?
I say if I had to pick one that has the most, my most attention, it's probably tech, because if rates, if we can get rates to stop going up at all and get a 50 bit pullback, I think tech is close to getting towards the bottom in relative terms. So I think when you look at valuations on tech and how much they've come in, I think tech presents itself with potential outperformance opportunity, but you don't want to keep seeing rates moving higher. And another thing that a lot of people are not aware of is that the game is going to look very different on July 1st when you have the Russell rebalance, because there's a very high likelihood that tech is going to get moved into the value area and energy is going to get moved into the growth area. So growth versus value is also going to take on a very different meaning in less than a month. I think people are going to need to, you know, there's going to be a lot of confusion over how to play that going forward, because the components are going to change dramatically.
Very interesting, Rick. We're going to wrap it up here. We've covered a lot, and I really like the broad comments early on about what the Fed is doing, how the markets are reacting, and again, realizing what type of a market this is, a bear market, and a bear market that hasn't just come with one or two shocks to the system. This is something that is pulling down pretty much every sector. And that's tough for investors to know what to do, because I don't think a lot of investors have faced this sort of a bear market. I honestly can't truly remember a bear market that I've been that active in that has been this orderly and still seems very early on in the pullback. Rick, thank you as always for your time. It's great chatting with you. And hey, keep crushing that S&P. I really love what you're doing with that 7-Eleven report. We'll post a link within the weekend show posting so you can find out more about Rick's products. Rick, again, thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys. It's a pleasure.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.